Hello comrades, and welcome back to Season 4, Episode 5 of Spectre. I'm absolutely delighted to be talking about the London recruits today, and who better to talk on the subject than London recruit Steve Marsland. Steve, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on today.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm delighted, you know, you did so, and happy to be of assistance.
Cheers. I guess just to start us off then, Steve, a wee kind of introduction from yourself, you know, who you are, your affiliations and everything else in between.
Okay, right. Well, I joined the YCL back in, I think, 1969. And straight away, they put me to work on setting up the TUC Youth Conference, or campaigning for it. I was the London Secretary, and another comrade, Pete Kavner, at that time was the National Secretary. And we got a big conference in Manchester, and we lobbied Vic Feather, who was the TUC General Secretary, and we won. They were reluctant at first, but we won, and TUC Youth Conference was set up somewhere around 1970, I think, like that. A couple of years later, I was asked to carry out a clandestine mission to South Africa, which was highly successful, but we'll go into all that later. I also co-founded the Toothless campaign. I lost both my dentists, and so we started that campaign, and that campaign is nationwide now and has loads of affiliations, and we are getting somewhere into defeating the dental deserts, so to speak. I did leave the Communist Party when it, as far as I was concerned, was no longer a Communist Party worth its salt, I joined the Labour Party, and I became a Labour Party councillor in London Borough Southwark. I soon got very disillusioned with Labour, and later on, after Keir Starmer came in, I rejoined the Communist Party, and it's the best decision I've ever made in my life, quite honestly. Delighted to be back. And also, can I just say how proud I am that the Young Communist League gave me lifetime membership as an honorary member. I do consider that a tremendous honor, and I'd like to thank everybody in the YCL for that. You know, it's something I'll take to the grave with me.
Oh, cheers for that, Steve. That's brilliant. I do remember that night being there for the Forward Awards. That was a great night. It's just that the subject to the London recruits has kind of been dead fascinating for me ever since kind of like finding out more about it. I felt like when I was looking to do an episode with you or with somebody for the London recruits, I was trying to figure out, you know, what can they talk about when it comes to it, because all the work that went into it. But, you know, it really is one of the monumental kind of like things that happened. And I think there's a tendency in the left to, well, the left for a broad sense of a term, but, you know, we don't always shout about our victories, even if it's the actions that, you know, historically we've been told are just not possible. So I think it's more important now than ever to really showcase that, you know, the battles that we've won in the past and how that all comes together for, you know, a wider fight. So I guess kind of diving into the first point, you can't really look at the extent of the fight against South African apartheid without looking at the historical, you know, backdrop to it, especially during the era of the Cold War with South Africa. It's always played an important part for the West in terms of resource extraction and cementing its position within Africa as a continent as well. The various laws, such as the past laws and the actual system of apartheid that was constructed, it's not something that was superficial or came about you know, on its own. It was a very, you know, calculated effort that took various shapes. So I'm just looking to see if you can give us a wee bit of the, you know, the political and historical context to South Africa, the setting up of the apartheid, as well as the counter to that from the likes of the ANC and the Spear of the Nation.
Yes, well, Britain is responsible for the apartheid regime. They set up the first constitution in 1910, deliberately excluding all people other than white people from power. That was Britain's decision in 1910. There was no hint that anyone could have majority rule in South Africa, in the Union of South Africa, when it was set up. People like to pretend that the apartheid system only it was taken about by the victory of the Nationalist Party in 1948, but it was going that way anyway, and repression, and it was becoming a totalitarian state where 80% of the majority of people in that country had no say in what was going on or whatever. The kind of laws that the South African working class were fighting against were the pass laws, as you say, and what shook the world and galvanized people was the Sharpeville massacre in 1960, because African people protesting about the fact that they had to show pass cards, and of course white people didn't. And the South African police opened fire on them, killing many of them and injuring many of them. And people woke up to the fact that this was a totalitarian regime. What was the attitude to the capitalist world to South Africa? It was full support, absolutely full support. We had to battle to get any kind of change going. We were looked upon for a little while as people like cranks. Old South Africa's, a member of the Commonwealth, and it's one of our own, etc., etc. It's because of the resources, because they were cheap, and so Britain wanted to continue trading with them and turn a blind eye to their laws and statements. I mean, the South African regime told you who you could fall in love with. They had pencil tests for your hair. Every park had blanc, non-blanc benches. Every cinema, everything was separate development, as they called it, racism, as we call it, a legacy of the colonialist system. But bit by bit, the ANC became less of a passive argument, but more aggressive, more st stating it. And of course, they got banned. And the situation that we had in fighting South Africa, we gradually became an anti-apartheid movement to be proud of in this country. And our party and our Young Communist League played a full part in developing the anti-apartheid movement, along with others, along with many other political groups. We were just part of it, but a very strong part of it. They said we couldn't do anything, that protest was futile, but we did protest, and we stopped their rugby tours, we stopped their cricket tours, we kicked them out of the Olympic Games, we stopped buying their wine, we stopped buying their apples and their grapes. And people were amazed that this small little group that started it actually became bigger and bigger and bigger, to be one of the mass movements and the mass demonstrations going. In South Africa itself, it was obvious that peaceful protest was absolutely useless, that there had to be an armed struggle developing, and Umkhonto was Sizwe, the spirit of the nation, was developed. But disaster struck at Rivonia, the farmland there. Many of the ANC Central Committee were arrested. Some, the whole leadership was in a state of disarray, either murdered, in prison for life, or in exile. And they were at their lowest ebb in 1971, and that's kind of where we came in.
Yeah, no, it's a great rundown, Steve. I mean, I've got the the London Recruits kind of educational resource in front of me, and it really has a great kind of a breakdown into the kind of system of apartheid as well. Like you said, the various kind of laws that existed back then that we can see almost replicated elsewhere in the world as well. So no, I do thank you for the kind of breakdown there as well, and on the kind of subject of Britain's involvement within the setting up and then the maintenance of the apartheid regime. Obviously, we'll come on to talk about some of that later on as well. But I think it's one of those ones, I guess, when you're younger and you're seeing all this and you're seeing the likes of what's happening in Palestine and now in Gaza. You look back to the likes of the South Africa, and you can see this kind of repeat with the BDS movement. And like you say, it's trying to stop those sporting events. We've already had it up here in Scotland as well when the Israel national team came. But the protection that it seems to be even more rampant now by the British state, you know, instead of just cancelling the event altogether, they'll just close the stadium so fans can't get inside. There's as a result of harsher protest laws enacted by the Tories, you know, you've got campaigners planning things and they're getting arrested before they can even enact simple picket lines against, you know, sports teams arriving at venues, show racism, the red card. They had their big kind of demonstration up in Aberdeen where it was a Israeli national player playing for the Bulls, and the police response there was absolutely crazy. Armed police officers called to demonstrators, many of them, well, older, if you forgive me for saying, but older and, you know, really, really, really harsh. So seeing this kind of pinpointed in one part of history to today with the likes of Palestine and that, it's kind of breathtaking to think, you know, we're right back to what's existed previously. And again, I guess that's why, you know, I feel there's a need for covering these kind of stories, because ultimately what you've just talked about in the political and historical context of South Africa is something almost identical to what's going on with, you know, Israel's Zionistic apartheid system that it enacts. So no, really appreciate the breakdown there. And again, the main subject focusing on the London recruits and, you know, the actions that you guys done yourself. For those who might be unfamiliar, because I certainly was, for the London recruit story, it's definitely not something you're taught about in school, the kind of anti-apartheid movement and the sheer scale of it. So I'm just looking to see if you can give us, you know, a breakdown into who the London recruits are, you know, what yous did and that. Well, it'll probably be pretty obvious what motivated you, but you know, the motivation that really pushed you to do something quite so dangerous, especially at that time.
Well, the London recruits were a sort of diverse group, really. What happened, and you can see this in the film, it was Oliver Tambo's idea to try and recruit, because the opposition to apartheid was smashed. They actually believed they would rule for 1,000 years, the apartheid regime, because they had got rid of the ANC. Oliver Tambo from, I think it was Tanzania or it might have been Zambia, at his headquarters. And he talked to Ronnie Kansrals and he said, "We're sending you off to London because the only Achilles heel we've got against the apartheid regime is they think all white people are on their side. So if you can come to London and talk to people and try and get people, after you've spoken to them, who you think might be willing to go out to South Africa and carry out agitational work on behalf of the African National Congress." So Ronnie did, and he joined a team of Joe Slovo, PM Dadu, and God, I've forgotten his name, Jack Hodgson. And they said to Ronnie, "Go to the LSE. Why don't you join as a student? Because it's a hotbed of radicalism. And, you know, make friends there and see if there's any opportunities for people who might be interested in taking out revolutionary work. So he did that mainly in the sort of late 60s and that, and some members of the then International Socialists, now SWP, were recruited. But the majority of the recruits, 70% of them, were from the YCL and Communist Party of our country. This was organised by our International Secretary, Jack Woodis, who passed the baton down to the YCL national organisers. So, in particularly, one person for me. So, how it worked was, in my case, I'd been a member of the YCL for a year or two, and I was approached by Bob Allen, who was the London organiser of the YCL at the time, and said, I want you to meet someone. I said, Bob, I'm always meeting people. What you? He said, no, this is a South African person, part of the ANC, and I want you to take someone with you. So I said, all right, well, Sean Hosey, my big mate, too. And he said, oh, that's fantastic. So we met Ronnie in a pub in Soho, and he explained to us what the situation would be. And the situation would be that we were to learn how to handle explosives. We weren't going to kill anyone or hurt anyone, but we were going to learn to make leaflet bombs. These bombs went straight up in the air, and the idea was that we would plant them at railway stations, bus stations, where the African working class were going back to their townships, and tell them that the ANC still lives, that it was not dead, and it was coming there. So we had to do that because you couldn't hand out leaflets on the street. Straight away, you'd be arrested and tortured. Incidentally, great credit to the ANC and the South African Communist Party. They did explain absolutely crystal clear what would happen if we were caught. That we would be tortured, we would put in solitary confinement, and the minimum sentence that we would get would be 5 years, no remission for political prisoners. And it's a bit tougher in a South African prison than our own, so, as unfortunately Sean Hosey found out. But that was how they approached it. And we went, me and Sean went, wow, can we think about it? And we did have a discussion, but we were never going to back out. I'm never going to back down. We were always going to do it. And of course, we were told, we learned tradecraft. We're going into a police state, so you have to learn, to look around you, look in windows, make sure you're not followed, double back, do all these things that you learn. We had to do that, and then we had to learn our DIY skills of how to set all these explosives up. And that took time because neither me or Sean were very good at the old DIY stuff. So we took ages, but we mastered it in the end. So who were the recruits? Well, there were electricians. As I say, there were some LSE students, but there were electricians, railwaymen, postmen, insurance salesman. I mean, there was all sorts in our particular one. The film concentrates on the leaflet bombs because they made such an impact on South Africa. We didn't realise that at the time, but later on, the comrades from South Africa told us what a difference it made. But there were other people who joined ships, went to merchant ships, and smuggled stuff in from there. They were posing as married couples. We were posing as businessmen, me and Sean. There are other people posing as married couples, all smuggling in, and later on, we smuggled in, some recruits smuggled in arms. This is about 10, 11 years after that. A safari company was set up, and the people didn't know, but underneath there was false bombs and all sorts of machine guns and Kalashnikovs and God knows what else was actually being smuggled in. That was when we had comrades in the interior. The time I'm talking about, 1970, 71, that was all gone, but it built up. And part of it built up because of what, I must say, we didn't know, me and Sean, that we were part of a team of five or six. There were five teams all letting off these leaflet bombs on the same day at the same time to make a maximum impact. But we didn't know that. We were, it was really a question of knowing as little as possible so that if we did get caught and we did get captured, we couldn't tell them that much anyway. But so it was a great surprise when we found out that not only were leaflet bombs successfully detonated in Cape Town, but they also were in Joburg, in Port Elizabeth, in Durban, and it made massive front page news in every newspaper in South Africa. They'd no, you know, they just didn't know what hit them. And it was a massive boost to the movement. I'm told, people have come up to me and said, look, this was so important. We were all, some of them were thinking of giving up, because it was futile. But that, so it did make a difference, but we didn't know that at the time.
No, that's great. Cheers for that, Steve. I love that about the kind of the London recruits as well. It's like so many folk from different backgrounds and trades, especially. And again, I'm talking about like repeating history. You look to the likes of the, I'm thinking of the International Brigades, because recently I was at a book launch in regards to the story of Bob Hilliard. And it is that story from the different volunteers who went, who are simple woodworkers, bricklayers, and it kind of showcases that the fight against apartheid, the fight against any form of racism, fascism, is very much based and absolutely steeped in class and the the effect that it's had, the victories. It goes to show what the workers' movement is capable of and what it can do, even operating in such clandestine manners. It's capable of achieving that, and that's what I really kind of love about the London recruits, how diverse it was as well, and especially the
Well,
work. Not to mention that the work you've done was really diverse.
can I just say, that it's very important for people to realise that we grew out of the mass movement against anti-apartheid. Although we were clandestine, although we were special, and although I thought it was a fantastic privilege to be asked, we grew out of that movement. And that movement was wide. It included churchmen, liberals, and things like that. I mean, all right, they didn't take part in what we did and risk the next, but we were part of that movement. And without the anti-apartheid movement that grew in this country, I don't think it would have been possible for us to do what we did. So although we were, I suppose, quite brave, if you like, we did grow from a large base of people who were committed to ending the apartheid regime.
Yeah, no, definitely agree. And I guess kind of you've touched on it already, but the work that the London recruits did, obviously you've focused mainly on kind of agitprop and that as well with the leaflet bombs, but also there was the likes of broadcasting. Again, you've mentioned the kind of smuggling in of arms. So I was just looking to see, although you've kind of touched on it, but what other work did the London recruits do, and how did this, especially as probably some of the harsher stuff, like the smuggling of arms, how important of a role did that play against the struggle against apartheid, especially with how the apartheid regime in South Africa grew to evolve and combat the anti-apartheid movement itself. So just to see if you can give us a breakdown of that.
Well, of course, when you're engaged in struggle, One of the great motivations is to know that you're not alone, and to know that there is a movement around that is actually supporting you and growing. So when we were doing these, what would you call them, agitational, revolutionary perhaps, actions, we always knew that someone was, there was backup. There were people who were absolutely going to be behind us. And when you're part of that movement, and I'm talking about myself perhaps, but when you're part of that movement, you are so proud to be asked to be invited to do some agitation work. We had other people who were engaged in trying to get ships to land and get false passes and things like that. We'll come on to that insurance case later on, and Alexander Mabaris. But there were whole ranges. But I have to stress, we didn't do this from an ultra-leftist point of view. We did it because we were invited by the main movement, the African National Congress, to help them to participate in them. The same when we, at the same time as the anti-apartheid movement was building up, we were also heavily involved in the solidarity with Vietnam and to kick the USA out of Vietnam. And we had the same situation in the Communist Party, particularly. We asked them, what do you want us to do? And they said, well, medical aid, so we'd set up the medical aid for Vietnam. We didn't try and tell the Revolutionary Party of Vietnam how to conduct their revolution. We left that to some ultra-leftist elements, very arrogant, I think, at the time. But we said, no, how can we help? And it was the same with the apartheid regime and the same with the Palestinian situation in Gaza. How can we help? What can we do for you? What solidarity work do you want us to do? The same in Spain in the 1930s. What was the party's position? What was the International Brigade's position? It was, how can we help? What do you want us to do? And we set up the International Brigade, and many people, lost their lives. But it's all about not trying to take over a revolutionary movement or be better than them. It's about what your actually role is. And your role is support. Your role is support, and you do that because you believe in it, but you're also going in and showing solidarity with a movement that you believe in. If you're, as far as I was concerned, South Africa was a class issue. It was the majority of the working class in South Africa were being oppressed. And we had a chance to change that. Yes, it took a particular form of apartheid, but that was only because the capitalist class devised that in that situation. In any situation, I think we always have to try and look at it in a way where we can be useful. One of the great freedoms that we have is the freedom to be useful. And one of the things in a socialist movement is they give you that freedom to be useful. So whether it's on a demonstration, a march, a protest, clandestine work, or anything like that, you've got the freedom to be useful. And that's the most important freedom you can have. And, I'm an old git of 74 now, and I'm still going. So, there's no excuse for anybody else, is there? So we do struggle like that. So that's the kind of things that recruits did. Recruits did whatever the political wing of the ANC asked us to do. In my case, it was leaflet bombs and delivering parcels and stuff like that. In other times, it's been different things. Like I said about the people in the shipping, people in the shipping in arms and things like that, and countless other things that I can't talk about that people did. But it was all about listening and actually trying to be of assistance to a movement that was going to overthrow the apartheid regime. And we did.
Oh, cheers for that, Steve. That's brilliant. And it really is. I keep referring back to the London Recruits kind of resource I've got as well, because it really does dive into the kind of work, and like you're saying about the likes of the broadcast and what the agitprop especially. It is that, solidarity. It's, folk who are against apartheid living, in that area, knowing that there's a movement behind them, and it still exists, even though the brutal repressions that were acted against the likes of the ANC and MD against the apartheid regime. And it still just stuns me. I don't know if I can really put it into words, but it really is kind of, you think of the scope and the scale, how far away Africa is compared to Britain. Logistics and everything else in between, it's absolutely mind-blowing to me.
Can I just, because you use the resource, and I was the coordinator of that resource, but it might be interesting you to say how that come about. The Action for Southern Africa asked me to go into a school in London and talk about apartheid and the apartheid regime and what we did. And so I went into that school and I started talking about apartheid. And they didn't have a clue what I was on about. So I stopped. I was a teacher before, so I stopped. I said, "Does anyone know what apartheid is?" And they all said, "No." And I thought, wow. I said, "Is there no?" And so I turned to them. I said, "Is there no resources about the situation in South Africa?" They said, "No, Steve, there isn't. And the reason for that is because we won. If we'd have lost, we'd have been, it'd be all over the history books." So I said, "Well, I'm not having that." So I got a load of recruits together and I said, "Look, there is no real history of what apartheid was, what the Sharpeville massacre was, what the Soweto uprising was, what the recruits did, what Africa did, what Mandela." I said, "This that don't seem to be hardly anything." So I said, "The only re way to do it is, we'll have to do write it ourselves." And I went, "Oh, I'm not a writer." I said, "Well, I'm not a writer, but we can have a go." So we got some help from the NEU and a grant. And the resource book you're talking about was put together mainly by London recruits. It's not about the recruits. There are some case studies, but we got in contact with the anti-apartheid movement. They gave us all their historical stuff. The NEU gave us a grant for the design, etc., like that. But that's the kind of thing. And quite honestly, at the time, I was absolutely shocked that we were hidden from history. And it's the same with the Vietnam War. Nobody talks about the Vietnam War and the historical struggle of the Vietnamese people because they won. They made a big mistake. They won. So it's true that there is a class nature when history is taught in schools, and any victories of the left is quietly shunted aside. A bit like the Tory Party, who now claim they were Nelson Mandela's best friend, when at the time they were. They had badges on saying "Hang Mandela," he was treated by Thatcher and that as a terrorist, and now they're saying, "Oh no, he's like Martin Luther King." Well, they sway with the wind, don't
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. I mean, it kind of goes to show it's why we don't let the forces of the ruling class decide the history, and it's why it's so important to, highlight the stuff like the London Recruits, the film, the resources, and everything else in between. So no, you're absolutely spot on. And I guess kind of going on to the next part, I've obviously from the agenda that I sent you, I was looking at picking apart the some of the recruits, and I guess some of the lessons to learn from them, and some of the facts. And one of the first ones was Ronnie Caswell's, and he had a great quote in the book, which I kind of liked, and it kind of highlights the real nature of the anti-apartheid movement. And he says, "We could have waged a war against the white population, but instead we emphasised that the struggle was against a system and not a skin colour." And I feel like that's the pinnacle of the anti-apartheid movement, and all the forces that were for the maintenance of the apartheid regime in South Africa continuously tried to smear the anti-apartheid forces as being, you know, anti-white and all that. And again, we're kind of drawn to history. The anti-Zionist movement is now being portrayed as anti-Jewish. So I really thought Ronnie's words and the resource bit were absolutely spot on, and that's the kind of the focus through the whole campaign against apartheid. It's against the actual system. It's not based on any skin color, because as we can kind of see from history, you know, apartheid can be enacted in any manner, against skin color, religion, ethnicity, you name it. So I was just looking to see, you know, if you had any, you know, thoughts on, you know, on Ronnie's words, and, you know, how important it was to always make sure that it was keeping that fight against the system of apartheid, recognizing it, explaining it, and essentially, you know, tearing it apart.
Yes, I mean, Ronnie's words are spot on. The ANC, even at its inception, was never a blacks-only movement. It was a movement that embraced everyone who agreed with the principles and later on the Freedom Charter. It included white people, white radicals, people like Dennis Goldberg and Bram Fischer, who were white, Jack Hodgson, and you know, so many more activists. And they took their part along with African and so-called Cape Coloured and Indian workers and leaders. It's very important. You can't call yourself a liberation movement if you're going to start excluding people. You're no good. You're no better than the apartheid regime. There was some lesser, smaller movements that did embrace anti-white, but as far as we were concerned, and the ANC later, and certainly the, you know, it's a class issue, and class has no colour. We actually approach these things, and we approach the membership of the ANC, and they stood steadfast, said, "No, we are for all South Africans, and the difference between us and the Nationalist Party is they are for 20% of the population, and we're for 100% of the population, and including everybody." And it's very, very important that we don't get dragged in, as you say, to when we're talking about Palestine, that we start being anti-Semitic. We're fighting the Israeli regime, as many, many people in Israel are as well. And we need to remember that, you know, we're not alone. Netanyahu is not very popular in Israel, and there are many, many Israelis who are appalled by what's going on. So we fight the system. We fight a system of colonialism. We fight the system of imperialism, and it has no colour. We will attack repression wherever it is and wherever we see it, hopefully. So Ronnie's words are absolutely spot on, and that was the ethos of the ANC, literally right from the start in 1912 when it was formed.
No, that's brilliant, Steve. I don't think I could even add anything else onto that. You've hit the nail on the head there. And I guess moving on to one of the next recruits, as you touched on him earlier, Sean Hosie. Again, referring back to the kind of London Recruits resource piece, it's quite an interesting story. And obviously, Sean was one of the unlucky ones who did get arrested and imprisoned. And I guess looking at the reality of that, because obviously you've already said that there was no sugarcoating from MD for the party, for the ANC, saying what would happen. It was very much in your face, and you know, you just knew the risks. But I guess it's one thing knowing the risks, and then next thing you know, having the handcuffs put on you and putting a prison in a South African prison, no less. And I think Sean's kind of story is it really shows the kind of strength in the jaws of imprisonment and having that refusal to denounce the ANC. That was the brutality. A lot of the prison guards has been highlighted, obviously in the resource, but as well as just historically as well, how brutal they were, not only to those in the ANC who are arrested and imprisoned, but especially to anyone who, allied with him. So I was just looking to see if, you had any thoughts on kind of the position of Sean and others that found themselves in prison, and what can be learned from their resistance.
Well, as regards Sean Hosey, if you like, I recruited him because he was a mate of mine. He weren't just, he was a drinking pal and a good laugh, and I really liked him. So we went out to South Africa together. In actual fact, he took my place at the last minute. What happened was, between the first agitational work we carried out, there was an emergency which the ANC asked me to go out there again and to smuggle in passes and money. I couldn't really go because I was on my first teaching practice, so I suggested Sean, and he went out and took my place and walked into a trap that we didn't know about. So he was arrested, tortured. He was trying to hold out for 48 hours so we could sort things out at our end, which we did. And he was in solitary confinement for about 6 or 7 months, brutally tortured. And then he was given the opportunity to denounce at his trial, denounce the ANC and denounce the movement, say he was duped. He now realizes the error of his ways, and if he did that, they would almost certainly let him go. And he told them, "Get stuffed, I'm not doing that." And so he got 5 years, no remission. Incredibly brave person. I'm still regular touch with him now. We live in different parts of the country, but he's an example of someone who was incredibly brave. And I think, there is no other words for him. I admire him, amazing him. He just says, "Oh, it's nothing, it's nothing." But it was. And he was quite difficult. He found I think he found freedom more difficult than he found the incarceration when he came back. But he's fine now. He's got children, and he's absolutely brilliant, and I see him at least 3 or 4 times a year. But no, an incredible person, really. My admiration for him, because we all think we'd do the same, but you don't know till you're in that situation. And they hurt him pretty badly. For example, they took him to his own grave. They said, "This is your grave, this is where we're burying you." Pulled a gun on him and put it to his head and pulled the trigger. He wasn't to know it was a starting pistol. He fell into his own supposed grave where they urinated on him and laughed at him and stuff like that, and then took him back for more beatings. So, they didn't get anything from him. I cleared out his digs. I went round there straight away, took everything out that might be, and told his landlady that if anyone comes calling trying to pretend they're friends of Sean, they won't be friends of Sean. Don't let them in. They did. It was a long-haired Bureau of State Security, and she told him where to go. And I was followed, and the phone tapped and that, but after the trial ended, that all finished. So they weren't too bad on me, but they found out about me, obviously. So I was a banned person, on their register list. But Sean, incredible, incredible, brave, still articulate, still absolutely brilliant when he does the film talks, question and answers with us. He's a fantastic, an incredible example. And of course, he was a member of the Young Communist League at that time.
Oh, cheers for that, Stephen. I guess Sean's got pints from you for life for that last minute swap. Then I know I'd certainly be pulling that trick if it was me.
Yeah, he never wants to talk about that. And I try and say to him, "Look, I'm ever so sorry. Don't you mention it. Don't you mention it." Yeah, it's a bond, really. And we've been we're pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean you're absolutely right, I guess, about the kind of you saying you do the same thing, but unless you're absolutely there in a prison like that, isolated for everybody else that it's a totally different situation. And I think we touched on the fact that the recruits were so kind of diverse in terms of their lives as students, tradesmen, and all that. But often I feel like we talk about, people's stories and all that. We often forget, the lives that they have as well, family, friends and everything, partners, and to, be willing to, risk that, to, help others is, it is really amazing when you put it all into perspective beyond the actions and beyond the final victory to really delve into, their lives and everything, and what they had willing to give up is it really is breathtaking and kind of cements it for them as well. But I guess moving on to one of the other recruits, Bob Newland. We touched kind of earlier on about the involvement of the British state, obviously setting up the apartheid regime in South Africa, but also maintaining it. You said as well the being aware of your surroundings during your actions there whilst under clandestine activity. Bob kind of touches in the resource in the London Recruits book about special branch activity and how deeply involved they were in combating both the, I guess, the domestic anti-apartheid movement here in Britain, as well as the clandestine operations as well. So and as well as that, Bob, when I was reading the book as well, I never realised that it was actually Bob, part of that Escape from Pretoria movie as well, with Daniel Radcliffe, about escaping from apartheid incarceration, which is absolutely amazing. But I'll probably leave it to you to kind of talk in that. You'll certainly give it justice, but just looking to see if you can give a kind of rundown or your thoughts on the British state involvement within South Africa at the time and what that meant as well for those back home.
Right. Well, the Bureau of State Security boss in South Africa and our special branch, MI5 or MI6 or whatever they are, were hand in glove. They allowed one of the leading members of the state security was McPherson. I think his name was Brigadier, and he was involved in the interrogation of Sean, and he was also involved in all the suppression of the ANC and activists. But he also orchestrated, he put bombs into these security diplomatic bags and came over to London and carried out a terrorist attack on the ANC headquarters. One person was injured. He was only allowed to do that because of the say-so of our Secret Service. At the time, they said, "Oh, we don't know who did it." But of course, with the Truth and Reconciliation Committees that happened after the apartheid regime was finished, they actually admitted it was them, and they had the connivance of our special branch. So, there was, as far as they were concerned, the apartheid regime was absolutely fine and wonderful. The film you're talking about, Escape to Pretoria, that involved Alexander Mabaris. Mabaris was one of the London recruits. His job was to ferry comrades from the ANC back into South Africa. He'd drop them off and then pick them up again once they'd crossed the border. He got caught. He got sentenced to 12 years. He and his wife were arrested. The French authorities put a lot of pressure on them to let his wife go, who was pregnant, and she was let go after about 4 or 5 months. Alex escaped. Incredible escape, really. But that's all in Escape to Pretoria and Tim Jenkins' book, which you can get and read about how they got through about 35 locks and managed to escape and grow to freedom. But you know, Alex was one of our London recruits. He was recruited by us. So yeah, I mean, the security system there was all encompassing. They were involved in the trade union movement. They had grants. I mean, they offered a lot of money to a lot of people. And you know, like in any struggle, you do get people who think, well, you know, freedom is never going to happen. I might as well cash in. So they had informants all over the place. And they became less and less as the movement became stronger and stronger to overthrow the regime. But certainly it was a policy that we all, you know, we all got together and we struggled. But we were always aware, and our comrades in the ANC always made us aware that secrecy and surveillance were uppermost. That, you know, Big Brother, if you like, was everywhere, and you had to be really, really careful who you spoke to, who you're doing. I mean, the recruits never spoke about this. 25 to 27 years, we kept silent. That's why it only emerged after 1994. You know, no one ever knew what we did, and no one talked about it. It's incredible, really. My wife was absolutely shocked when I told her, you know, when I was the person that coordinated with this was a London recruit called Ken Keeble. And Ken decided, he asked permission, could he get everyone together for his book, London Recruits, The Secret War Against Apartheid? So he spent ages and ages trying to contact people who may or may not have gone to South Africa, and would they write their story? And we did. And I'll tell you, this is a true story. We were invited by Peter Hain, who's now Lord Hain of Neath, but he was a Labour MP and he was an anti-apartheid activist, had to escape South Africa with his family to come to England. He invited all of us to the House of Commons, and two people sat down, two women sat down, because there was plenty of women in the London recruits. They sat down and I said, "Oh, hello, what are you doing here?" She said, "Well, I was a London recruit." And then I said, "Well, I was a London recruit." They had worked together for about 10 years to get, and neither of them knew anything about what they did. Nobody knew what we did. It was just, we were absolutely, the emphasis was on secrecy. I mean, you know, we didn't have Facebook then or all the other stuff you get now. So, I mean, it was a lot easier, but you know, you couldn't talk about it to anybody. I mean, it was just drummed into you. You know, you could be talking to the wrong person. You've got to be careful. I don't think we were that careful, but we tried to be. And certainly this was something that surprised everybody because nobody knew about it. And that's the strength of character of the people that were chosen. And I think it's a testament to people like Bob Allen, who recruited people, that they did choose the right people who could keep their mouths shut.
Yeah, no, I love that. I mean, it's kind of like seeing that the recruits for all their backgrounds and all that were, you know, they're not hardly trained spies by, you know, any stretch. They were, you know, people committed and motivated to, you know, end apartheid and, you know, to be up against the full force of, you know, Britain's state security services is, you know, it's crazy. It really is. And I like how you're saying about the kind of change in the modern world. I can't imagine any of the recruits posting on Twitter what they're up to and all that. I just checked into my hotel in South Africa. So they're certainly different though.
Picture of me food, you know, and all that. Give over. I'm old school.
know, I think that's great. And I guess moving on to the next recruit as well, well, one of the next people in the resource book for the London recruits, Dennis Goldberg, obviously his section's written in memoriam, but his story is absolutely brilliant, and it kind of touched on as well during his time in incarceration was that the apartheid regime was even alive in the prisons themselves. And for me, that just kind of really highlighted the brutality of a system like that, where it's people incarcerated for whatever reason are still kept and locked, if you like, in an apartheid regime. Even in prison, there's no escape from it. But Dennis's story is really quite breathtaking. So I'm just wondering if you'd be able to do it justice better than me, just kind of about Dennis's life and all that, and what role he played in the fight against apartheid.
The word hero is used far too much, but in his case, it's absolutely justified. He is a man who had privileges or could have had privileges, saw the injustice of the regime, and took on a full role in ending that and participating in the ANC. He was captured. Obviously tortured, because that's what they do. And I think he got 20, he was let out after 22 years in a South African prison. Now, you would think that he might turn around after that time and think, look, I've done all this, I've done that. No, he got straight to London and went and organized all sorts of activities, anti-apartheid activities, hardly paused for breath, just carried on working to overthrow the regime. And his work and the amount of work that he did in setting up all sorts of resources in South Africa, humanitarian resources in South Africa, his work is breathtaking. And he is an absolute inspiration. He's one of the, he's a bit like Oliver Tambo. He's the unsung heroes of the resistance movement. And when you look at his life and when you look at his determination to end injustice and end apartheid, and he carried on right up until his demise, he's incredible, absolutely incredible. The enthusiasm, the energy and the absolute passionate commitment, a true socialist in every sense of the word. And I salute his memory, a red salute to his memory. An amazing man.
Yeah, oh, absolutely spot on. And like you said, that position he could have had and was willing to risk it as well within that regime is just, amazing. It goes to show that it touches on kind of Ronnie's words as well. It's the fight against the regime. It's not the fight against skin colour. It had nothing to do with it. And I guess Dennis really showcased that from his position as well. So obviously for those listening, if you get the chance, really delve into the kind of the life of Dennis and the work he done. It's in the resources, and it's I guess as Steve says, hero. Might be too short of a word for him, for what he's done because it really is amazing. And yeah, I guess to go on from Dennis then, how do we beat that? But we'll come on to Ken Keeble, who obviously you touched on the role he played in the noting history, as we've mentioned already, not leaving it to the forces of the ruling class to dictate the history or to say what was and what wasn't. But Ken's played a really good role, I think, in the highlighting and the uncovering of the stories that many of us now throughout the YCL, the party, and various other movements, we treasure. It's really interesting to hear these stories and to take lessons from them. So I'm just looking to see if you can give a wee rundown, of Ken's activity and especially the kind of role he's playing the now with, further promoting the likes of the movies like London Recruits, his written works as well, and anything else in between.
Right, well, Ken's story is an actual fact. If you've got the book Red Lives, Ken's father and mother are in that, written by Ken. Ken decided, because he was one of the recruits and he was out in South Africa, but he wanted to actually, when he got permission, to get all the recruit story together. And it was through his book that Gordon Main, the director of the film, approached, because he'd read this book and he thought, Wow, this is just story got to be told. So the film was 10 years in the making, but it's a direct result of the book that put together Ken Keeble put together. I remember getting an email and he said, are you the Steve Marsden that may have gone out? I said, yes, I was. He said, could you write something? I said, yeah, I'll write something. And it took time to get it together, but we did, and the Guardian newspaper wrote something, and the Times and the Independent wrote something about, oh, how didn't we know about this? Well, you didn't know about it because we never spoke about it. That's why you didn't know about it. You know, we were disciplined. But Ken has been inspirational in promoting the recruits, promoting the book, promoting the film. Like, you know, it's a for at least three, four, five of us have been doing this and promoting the film all over the country. He's just had his 80th birthday a little while ago, only a month or so ago, and you know, he's been a great comrade. Born in London, around the East End of London, he's been inspirational to so many of us, and I'd like to personally thank him for all the hard work that he's done, and I hope, you know, everyone appreciates just how important Ken Keeble is to this whole story. Because without Ken Keeble, I don't think a lot of this would have been possible. It would have been fragmented and that. He brought it all together. So yeah, it's a great honor to be able to talk about him because I think he's done such a great job for us.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, and the importance of being able to get the stories about the clandestine work. Never mind just, you know, the actual just the fact that, oh, I went there, but to go into detail about a lot of the work. I can't imagine how stressful it must have been, you know, trying to piece all the bits that folk were talking about and see when the statute of limitations had worn off on it or not. But it's absolutely fantastic to read about, and you know, especially some of the, you know. Really difficult work as well, and Ramila Patel, which is one of the next recruits I wanted to talk on, her story is quite interesting as well, and it touched a lot on the, you know, the, like I said, the London recruits weren't, you know, trained spies and everything that, you know, a lot of you guys were doing were, you know, picking it up as you went along. Obviously, folk were trying to train you as well, and you know what to look out for, what to do. But you know, Ramila's story about the operator of the safe houses as well, especially into the kind of later years of the fight against apartheid, where you know there's a strong armed resistance as well to the South Africa regime. So I was just wondering if you could give us a wee kind of rundown into Ramila and you know that importance of the actual safe houses and well, I can already imagine the difficulty of trying to, you know, keep them unnoticed and all that, but certainly the real importance of having them to tie in with the work that those from abroad, such as the recruits, may have had to use them, or as well those from the kind of armed wings as well, fighting against apartheid.
Yeah, well, we had later on, after with the leaflet bombs, they had a resistance interior. So it was very important that we had, they just, you know, had safe houses. And so recruits, I mean, Ramila, I think she was born in either Uganda or Kenya or something like that. But she lived most of her life in Bolton in Lancashire. And she was recruited to go out to South Africa and operate a front, a safe house in Botswana. Another recruit from the party was Will G, and he went out there and he had a safe house and operated a safe house as well. What did these safe houses do? Well, when comrades were on the run or were being followed or being difficult, they knew they could stay here in those houses. You know, as long as they liked, the people that ran the safe houses had jobs. I'm not sure what Will's job was, but Ramila was a teacher. And, you know, they played a very, very important role. They did messages, they did surveillance work, they did carrying out reconnaissance, safe routes into the interior, and all sorts of everyday jobs they did. But for all intents and purposes, to their neighbours, they were just ordinary people. But at night and things like that. I mean, her story's quite amazing, as is Will G's, quite amazing. They did a real, they were very important. Pete Smith, I think, ran safe houses as well, another London recruit. So out there and spent time out there, as well as other things that he did. His story's quite amazing as well. You know, these people were absolutely essential and vital for the smooth running of the revolutionary movement, because we were building and building at that time. They were sort of 1980s, I think, was the time when they were actually operating. And I know Rimila, she stayed in what was Swaziland, is now Eswatini, and I believe she's now teaching in Germany. I saw her a couple of days ago. Well, no, about a month ago, we were at the Rio in Dalston, and there was me, her, and Tariq Ali, old flame of the past. We were there, and she's in great spirits, and her what she did was quite amazing. And I know she's a great friend of Ronnie, and I've got a lovely picture of her with Nelson Mandela as well. So she was very, very important to the movement some 10, 12 years after our escapades.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I'll probably not say too much else in Ramallah because I really do want folk to kind of read the resource and then go into her story because I do quite like Ramallah's and like you said, the life she's lived after as well and being so active is brilliant. So I guess the last recruit to touch on then is obviously yourself, Steve, and your passage, your first opening passage and the resources is brilliant. It's how any good story starts, and it's you saying, I was minding my own business. So I'll leave it over to you to explain your business and just, you know, the role you played and everything else.
Well, it all started. I was let's go back to the beginning. I started when I was in this pub in South London. I don't know what I was doing there because it was a slightly out of my area, but not that much. And I got talking to this bloke, you know, and he started chatting away and stuff like that, and he's saying to me, you know. He said, "Oh, you're quite left wing then, aren't you?" I said, "Well, yeah, I suppose I am, you know." But he said, "Well, there's some folk music upstairs. It's been run by the Young Communist League." I said, "Look, I don't mind meeting people from the Young Communist League, but I bloody hate folk music. I'm a jazz fan. I don't mind a bit of soul, but I'm not having any of that finger in the ear stuff. You know, I can't stand that." So he said, "Well, come up anyway, you can see him afterwards." And I did. So, cut a long story short, I joined the YCL and was active for a while. And then Bob Allen came to me, sidled up to me, and he said, "You know, I've got this job for you." So that's what we did. Now, what you have to remember in the 1970s, after meeting Ronnie, he was giving me a plane ticket to go halfway around the world. You know, I'd never been abroad before at all. I mean, the nearest travel I'd done was a few Millwall away games, and that was only at Brighton and Southend. You know, I'd not been anywhere, and now he's turfing me off on a bloody mission. And yeah, but it was such an honour. It was such an honour. You know, I couldn't refuse. I just wanted to do it desperately. And I was with my mate Sean, so that was our story. But we learned how to develop these bombs and place them and that. And then the great day came. Oh, I suppose I should, because it's a reasonable part of the film. I did have a fond romance with the hotel receptionist, and that could have led us into trouble. Because, as far as I was concerned, she was just a South African who hated apartheid. I didn't realise she was classed as a Cape coloured. She'd asked to be, they'd asked her, the authorities had said, "Will you apply to be white?" And she said, "Sod off." So we're in this restaurant, me, Sean, and two of these girls, and the police come in, and the girls freeze. We looked at him, Sean looks at me, I looked at him, I said, what's the matter? He said, well, we should have told you, we're not meant to be in this restaurant with you. It's a whites only restaurant, and we are classed as Cape Coloured. So that would have absolutely blown our mission. They'd have been in trouble, and so would have we. So we had to rethink things because we were there to do a job. So that was a hairy moment. But the worst moment that we had was when we were laying the bombs. We had this dodgy timer that kept going off on its own accord. I don't know what was wrong with the bloody thing, but anyway. So we were laying them at the bus stations and we were laying them at railway stations. And then we had one over. So I said to him, come on, Sean, let's have a laugh. Let's go to the Parliament and park it by the Parliament because they won't be expecting that. So we put a bomb by their Cape Town Parliament a little while away and then let that. But one of the bombs with this dodgy timer, and we took it in turns to set them, you set it to a 20 minutes or you set it to 15 because they all had to go off at the same time. As I've set it for 20 minutes, the bloody thing's come back and it's going to hit the detonator, it's going to explode, and we would have been arrested within seconds. So without thinking and being a bit stupid, I put my fingernail onto the detonator to stop it from detonating. Sean's as white as a sheet, God knows what I look like, and I've pulled it back again and it stopped. So we walked away and it did actually work, but it was a hairy moment. So obviously the bombs went off as clockwork. The African working people at first scared because it was a bomb and massive explosion, but then they saw the leaflets and they began dancing and singing, because they just looked at them and they thought, yeah, well, we're not alone. So that's absolutely brilliant. They got on their trains and trucks and railways and took these back and spread them out around the township. So it was a great success, and it was a great success in the other places as well, Durban and Port Elizabeth. And there were hairy moments in those. I won't spoil the film for people, but go and watch the film and you'll see some other scary moments as well, which the other groups did. Then we had another scary thing because the ANC had given us the wrong plane ticket. We had to get out because the radio was saying security forces are on the trail of these terrorists and, they're being it, arrests are imminent and that. So we thought, blimey, we better go. So we had this plane ticket from Cape Town to London, and they said there's no such plane. Oh, bloody hell. I said, what you'll have to do with this ticket, you'll have to go to Salisbury in Rhodesia, Harare, Zimbabwe now, and then get a plane from there. So he said, but you better hurry up, you ain't got a lot of time. So we started running in the airport, and these two policemen pulled their guns on us and said, stop, you can't run in an airport, blah, blah, blah. Everything was, it wasn't just stop, don't do that. They pulled their guns out. So I handed passports and I thought, that's it. They're going to connect. They're going to connect the bombs last night or, feet on. And we've had it. But they didn't. I just looked at them, said, all right, but you don't run. So, just walk fast. So we walked fast and we got home. And that was a bit of a hairy moment there. But all these things that you do when you're younger or when you're older and you carry on doing them, you learn so much about yourself. And when you're in, I mean, on a protest march, you learn so much. You learn you're not alone. One of the worst things we can be is alone and individualistic. We're part of a movement and we should celebrate that. Collectivism, that's what we're about, not individualism. So whatever we do that is good and revered or something like that. We're still part of the collective, and I wouldn't want it any other way. And that's why I still attend my branch meetings. I go sell the Morning Star and do things like that, because you're part of the collective. And I do it because I want to do it. I want to be part of that movement.
Brilliant, Steve. Thank you so much for that. So, I mean, I guess folk music was nearly the reason you never went in the first place. Love was nearly the end of it all. So it's a good combination there. But no, I think that's a brilliant story, and stories like that, it's Hollywood. It's like, can't believe that's happened. It's something out of a movie. You know, Tom Cruise is caught shorthanded, they check his passport. Yep, it's fine, on you go. And that's what it's like. So
Yeah,
I mean, it just
that's
relates.
absolutely true. But you just carry on, and I'd have loved to have sat down with my mates in the pub and told them all about it. But no, the lips were zipped. We were told not to, and that was it. We were part of a we were a small cog in a great movement, and that great movement went on to be victorious. And of course, I know, when we had the Wembley concerts for Free Mandela, and when he was finally freed, and the signs came down, Blanc, non blanc, and the cinemas were open to everyone, and everyone had a vote. Universal suffrage came to South Africa. It was a wonderful, wonderful moment, not just for me, but for everybody that opposed that regime, because we were told at the time that we were wasting our time, that there was no way a big, country like South Africa, that ruled Africa in many ways, could ever be overthrown. But they said the same with the Vietnam situation as well. So, whoops, whoops, there goes another rubber tree. Let's have high hopes. And we have high hopes for defeating the Israeli, vicious Israeli government in Palestine. We hope that there's going to be a peaceful solution in Sudan and in the Congo, and on we go, and on we fight, and we fight with our comrades, and we have to fight to get the situation in Cuba and the illegal blockade. I'm a member of the Cuban Solidarity Campaign, and that's another thing that we have to take up even stronger and better than we have done so far. There are so many issues in internationally, and so many issues in our own country, fighting the vicious cuts to this disabilities, the two-child rule, and the closing down of the pension enhancement at Christmas. I mean, that these are attacks by a Labour government, a so-called Labour government. They're an absolute disgrace to the name. They really are. I mean, attacking the working class the way they do. So the resistance has to be both internally and externally. And we'll be in there, we'll keep fighting, we'll keep struggling as long as we got breath. Our guiding light, The British Road to Socialism, actually is a very, very good read. And I try and read it at least once a year because it does inspire me. And I'd encourage others to do so as well.
Brilliant, Steve. Thank you very much for that. And no, good to hear you're still gonna keep the fight going. I just hope that you're not getting
Yeah.
your fingers caught in the letter bomb detonators again. Keep it safe.
In fact, one of the if I'd have got caught, one of the tortures they could have put on me is to make me listen to folk music 24 hours a day, and I'd have confessed. I'd have grassed everyone up. But if they put jazz on, if Miles Davis was there, they'd have had no chance, but so no, joking aside, you've got to be brave to avoid that. And Sean was incredibly brave, and Alex Mombaris was incredibly brave. No one knows how they're gonna react when you're in those situations, Nathan. But you like to think that you'll be tough kid, but you just don't know. But those two came through it, and they're still alive, the two of them together, and it's absolutely brilliant that they are. Going, we give them a massive salute for all that they did.
Yeah, superb. And I guess to almost wrap everything up then, we've talked about the the London recruits, the historical context in regards to South Africa's apartheid, but we're better to finish off than the actual fall of apartheid as well. And I guess, you know, being alive to witness it as well, so many kind of hard long fights and across the movement, I suppose, you know, were really, really tough. And you know, there were many people who did pay the ultimate price with their life as well. So I'm just looking to see, you know, what how was that, you know, reaction from yourself, the London recruits, you know, having that news of the fall of apartheid, because I imagine you still would have been in the main mindset, you know, keep your mouth shut about tons of things and not see anything. So trying to balance that level of raw emotion, but as well, you know, from this fall of apartheid, from the successful campaigns both domestically and Britain, like so the BDS movement to the clandestine workers we've talked about, you know, how can we learn, what lessons can we learn from that and put it into, you know, action against the similar systems that exist today?
Well, I think one of the lessons that we learned more than anything else was the importance of a mass movement, the importance of not going down a sectarian role, which is a cul-de-sac, and saying we've got our ideas and we're not going to compromise, we're not going to do anything. You know, we're pure and wonderful, and we don't need to engage with others. The anti-apartheid movement taught us that we could involve the clergy, and some of them played a fantastic role in the anti-apartheid. Bishop Trevor Huddleston, for one, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, they were incredible people and inspired people who perhaps wouldn't have been inspired in a socialist movement. And so we grew bigger and bigger. And as the apartheid regime was tottering, it became a real mass thing. It engaged a lot of pop musicians, the Specials particularly, and Gerry Dammers. I mean, these people did a lot to inspire young people about what was going on. And you know, you have to have a big. A big, you have to have a big, something's going on in my computer, but I'll try and finish. Hang on a minute, I'll see if I can get rid of it. You have to have a big. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right, okay, I'll carry on. Sorry.
MI5 must have heard me talking about you and letter bombs again, and they're
Yeah, I think it
starting to
is.
itch you.
All sorts of stuff coming up here. And I need to. Hang on a minute. I can get rid of it all, I think. Right. Oh, we're back. Right. I don't know what happened there. But anyway, one of the things was that the movement grew and grew and grew until, of course, at last we had the elections and the landslide victory for Mandela. But can I just say a special moment to one of the great inspirations to the movement, which was Chris Hani. Chris Hani was a young activist in the ANC and in the South African Communist Party. And in 1993, he was the General Secretary of the South African Communist Party and wrote some fantastic things. He was absolutely brilliant to hear him and his analysis. He's in the film at talking as he is. And what the South African regime did to sabotage the election, where knew they were going to get beat, I think, was carry out an assassination. So they killed him, hoping to start a race war. And it was only the discipline of the ANC that actually stopped that, because he was revered. He was the General Secretary of the South African Communist Party. He was a charismatic character, and they murdered him in cold blood. They tried to pretend it was some individual that did it, but we all know who was behind it. It was, you know, the apartheid regime. And so a special honour is Chris Hani. He was an amazing human being, a courageous, brilliant theorist, and brilliant activist who fought his way back to South Africa. and then was slain in order to start a race war. That was thwarted. The South African Communist Party and the African National Congress just said no. Eye on the prize, the election. We're not getting into this kind of and it could have easily happened. So a big up, big red salute to Chris Hanney, one of our great heroes of the communist movement.
Yeah, no, superb, Stephen. I guess just to really wrap off, just to see if you've got, any kind of conclusions, final talking points, and where can folk kind of get access to the resource material, on the London Recruits and obviously the film as well.
As regards the educational resource, I've got copies of it. You can contact me. We're actually got a special offer at the moment. We're selling the resource alongside Ronnie Caswell's How to Master Secret Work, which is a wonderful little pamphlet that Ronnie wrote in the 1980s, I think. Which we've reproduced, but it's all reproduced by Manifesto Press. We're selling both of those for £15. The resource is being revamped, so it's going to have a new cover and that, and it's being revamped to go into schools in Britain and South Africa. Ken Keeble's book you can get from any major bookshop, or you can order it. It's Merlin Press. So our one's Manifesto Press, that's Merlin Press. And of course the film's going all over the country at the moment. It won best documentary in the Johannesburg Film Festival. It won best film of the year in a festival in Cape Town, and won best anti-racist film in a 5-day festival in Cuba. And it's been going to enthusiastic audiences up and down the country, but not Scotland. So we're gonna sort that out, and we'll have to get to Glasgow and Edinburgh and Dundee and Aberdeen. That's your task, Nathan. I've just appointed you our envoy for Scotland to get the film on there, because it will be absolutely amazing. And of course, some of the recruits were Scottish. I know it says London recruits because they were recruited in London, but we had quite a few Scottish people as well. So that's where you can see the film. The film's all over. I mean, go on the London Recruits website and you can see where the film's next showing. I think it's showing today actually in London, but it's going all over. Milton Keynes is coming up, Manchester's coming up, and as you said, we're hoping to get Glasgow as soon as there. So be there or be square. Come and see the film. There's always a question and answer session. And I'd love to meet you all if it's one that I'm going to. It should be quite a blast. But they're always well attended, and we have a great time, and we have a few drinks afterwards. So, long as you're buying.
Oh, brilliant. Well, listeners, you've heard it here first. No pressure on me. I've got to get the whole of Scotland watching the London Recruits. Only I find that a big venue then. But no, cheers, Steve. Thanks very much again for your time for coming on. It's honestly, it is a real, real honour to be talking to you and that, and talking about the London Recruits. Like I said earlier, I think those in the on the left, we do fall short and really highlighting, heroes and those who've played, massive roles in the movement, and we often don't recognize them enough till it's, too late, and we're writing passages on them, in memoriam. So it's absolutely amazing to have this conversation with you and to get it out, across social media and the podcast format, and for folk tuning in on the YouTube one as well. It's really, really, really important we get these stories out and really drawing the lessons to be learnt for the struggles today, because ultimately it's yous who's showcased, what can be done. So it's important for us to try and, replicate that in this new age, in 2025, going into 2026, no doubt. We face horrendous difficulties. There's been so much advancements in technology to thwart, political protest, trade union organizing, and everything else in between. So, Not to sound doom and gloom for my generation, but it's a big uphill battle. But having the history of the likes of the London recruits and so many before us and different struggles, it's that for us is our historical broad movement, if you like, as you mentioned, that's our kind of, I guess, safety net, our support that really will inspire us and it continues to inspire us. So again, Steve, I just want to thank you for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. It's been really good. And thanks a lot, Nathan. And start booking those cinemas.
Thanks again, comrades, for tuning in to another episode of Spectre. As always, be sure to leave us a like and review on whatever platform you're tuning in on. Be sure to share us with your friends, co-workers, comrades, and everybody else in between. The London recruits stand as a testimony to the strength and resolve of the working class. They stand as a determined force against the apartheid regime and any and all apartheid regimes that follow after it. It's important for us to learn the lessons from the London recruits and the broader anti-apartheid movement. For it is these lessons that will carry on in our fight against apartheid in 2025. The Israeli apartheid against the Palestinian people has been brutal. Enacted forward by a brutal genocide, it is something we can't let sit by. We have to stand united as a class, beyond our skin colour, beyond our ethnicity, and beyond anything else in between. Let's take the lessons learned from Steve and their history and push it forward. Let's stand on the shoulders of the London recruits, giants of our movement. Let's stand on their shoulders and fight apartheid wherever it shows its ugly face. Let's stand together, united, once and for all.
Lord, I can't change.